The next case of the day is case number 03-1628, America's Money Line against Josephine Coleman. Mr. Getchell.
May it please the court, Duncan Getchell of Richmond, Virginia, for America's Money Line. I would submit that if my client had a naked contract with Ms. Coleman, that she would not bring a class action against us. And she did. And I brought an action in declaratory judgment or for an injunction that the amount in controversy would be determined precisely as I argued below, it would be determined precisely as it was in Rexford Rand, case on which two members of this panel sat. And I submit further that we should not get a different result in arbitration merely because we have proceeded by motion to compel arbitration instead of labeling it a declaratory judgment or an injunction action. Now, we certainly are not permitted to be hostile to a motion to compel arbitration as a matter of policy, because that would be the opposite of the public policy of the United States, which very much favors arbitration. And certainly there is nothing in the Federal Arbitration Act which compels a different analysis than the one employed in Rexford Rand. The controversy between the parties language has been held by We Care Hair to be the current dispute, the one I brought in federal court, not the underlying state court action. And the language averted to by the district court, quote, save for such agreement, is explained in detail by the Drexel-Burnham Lambert case as being a reflection of some very old law in which it was held as a matter of common law that an agreement to arbitrate ousted jurisdiction of a court. And so that language was put in there to nullify that line of reasoning. Now, I understand that an argument of the sort I am making, because it is one of first impression, will get a fair amount of scrutiny. And I understand that it will get that scrutiny in the context of the fact that there are a lot of parties who are trying to get into federal court from various jurisdictions in Illinois, including the one that I'm in. But the reason those attempts fail is because the parties are either ignoring the rule against aggregation when it comes to a class action, or because they're trying to remove it, in which case you only look at the well-pleaded complaint of the plaintiff, and you have to value the case in controversy by the underlying claim. Doctrinally, I am not evading either of those rules. Doctrinally, I'm saying that the motion to compel arbitration was, in essence, an equitable action, just like a declaratory judgment, just like an injunction, and that it should be valued as I valued it, which is the object of the litigation. The object of the litigation was to get the benefit of our bargain that there would be arbitration. And so in determining whether amount in controversy was satisfied, you look at that value to us. And we put in the only evidence on the point. And this is not evidence like you had in the Bankers, Florida Bankers case, where you had unreasonable opinions with respect to what punitive damages could be. This is a reasonable affidavit based upon the experience of my client as to what the litigation support costs are in fending off putative class actions, national class actions.
Don't you have to deduct the cost of the arbitration? I mean, it's a differential in cost, isn't it?
Well, except the arbitration clause clearly says that there can't be class arbitration. So the single party arbitration is a nominal value. the are nominal cost. In fact, that's noted by the U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly, that these are inexpensive and rapid procedures.
The state court can now order arbitration, can it?
The state court can order arbitration, but I was permitted to do a race to judgment, because the rule is, when you're dealing with different sovereigns, I can choose to bring my case in federal court, and if I get a judgment before one in the state court, then I'm permitted to do that. It doesn't.
Well, you can, but there's an agreement to arbitrate. I'm not sure I understand why the state court isn't bound by the agreement, just like the federal court.
The state court ultimately would be bound if we had to litigate it there. In fact, they would be bound as a matter of federal preemption to follow the Federal Arbitration Act. The fact of the matter, though, is that diversity jurisdiction permits me to choose my forum. I am not happy with the state forum because of its record. If you look on the website of the American Tort Reform Association, that particular jurisdiction has been labeled, if you'll excuse my language, a tort hell, precisely because of the way it handles class actions. So I, very prudently, I think, came to my federal forum, and I believe that it was error for me to be excluded on amount in controversy. I think that my submission is in accordance with established doctrine. It's the only way to get the benefit of our bargain, that is to have the court view the claim as it is valuable to us. And I submit that the only evidence was creditable, it was not unreasonable, and it was not even disputed below. So we are in a posture in this court that it is, in all probability, worth more than $75,000 to us. And the only question is, as a matter of law, can we take this approach? And I say that Rexford Rand says we can. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Getchell.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Ms. Renshaw.
May it please the court, counsel. This issue of determining the amount in controversy to reach the jurisdictional amount under 1332 in the context of an action brought under the Federal Arbitration Act has already been settled in this circuit and in others. The most recent case, Evans, there's Cottle, the Barbers, and We Care, all talk about determining that amount, and what they have determined is that it's the stake of the arbitration, and that is the amount that the arbitrator could award, as distinguished from what the state court could award. Now, in this case, that is not in dispute, that amount would exceed or meet the jurisdictional amount. So defendants raising a theory based on declaratory judgment and injunction. Now, there is a difference because of the language of Section 4, which says the jurisdiction, to meet the jurisdiction, you have to establish it on something other than the arbitration agreement. Yet, admittedly, that is exactly what they're basing their claim of meeting the jurisdictional amount on. And that can't be done. And that's why there's a big distinction between this value lost in the context of an injunction as opposed to the arbitration. There are a few other reasons why defendant's theory is flawed. And one is that they're claiming that they have to spend so much money on support staff helping attorneys handle a class action. Well, in effect, that's aggregating their claim to meet that jurisdictional amount. And if you want to follow the law, it would have to be how much it was for it to handle each individual claimant. And so you can't aggregate the claims. Another flaw in their standard is that the amount they're claiming is their as the value is too indirect. It's a byproduct. What they brought the petition for arbitration to achieve arbitration. The result of arbitration is an award. That's the value. Now, the byproduct is maybe that, yes, if they don't get back what they wanted, they will have to spend, but that can't be the basis for meeting that jurisdictional amount. To do so would really be expanding the concepts of federal jurisdiction, and it would invite almost everyone to come up with some kind of reason or amount that was a byproduct of bringing an action, and that can't be what was intended. Finally, they claim that they have proof that from their, one of the employees, that this amount would exceed. What the affidavit of that party says is that there's a substantial potential. Well, what's required is a probability, and there definitely is a distinction between potential and probability. So on that basis as well, they have not met the requirement for establishing a jurisdictional basis under 1332. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Renshaw. You have 3 minutes, Mr. Ketchum.
My opposing counsel says that this is settled. It is settled by Rexford Rand that the way to value this is for the value of the benefit of the object of the litigation to us, which in this case is to be valued in terms of not having to litigate, not litigate the class action. That's not the value that we said. That would raise questions perhaps of aggregation, but the not having to litigate the issue of whether there will be a class action is in fact the value to us of the object of the litigation to us. Now, there, an argument is made that we get a different result from Rexford Rand because of the language in the Federal Arbitration Act. I think I've already adequately addressed why that isn't so. The claim is made that this type of damage is too indirect. And I'm mindful of the cases in this circuit that say the claims for attorney's fees are not the controversy between the parties because they are too indirect. They are not the object of the controversy. They are not the controversy. They are incidental to the controversy. But here, enforcing the arbitration agreement that excludes class action treatment is the object. It is the direct object. It is not indirect. And furthermore, if the other side had questioned not the theory of my evidence below, but the sufficiency of it, that is, that I should have said a substantial probability rather than a substantial potential, I would have developed that further. It would be highly unjust, I think, to, for the first time on appeal, entertain an argument not raised below as to the sufficiency of the evidence. Rather, this court should reverse the incorrect doctrine followed by the court below and remand for further proceedings, at which time, if they wish to question the adequacy of their evidence, they may do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ketchum. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.